Well, we are nearing the finish line of our extended study, Old Testament journey through Exodus, starting with Genesis. Actually, sermon number one way back in February was a kind of an overview to lay out the context of what the Ten Commandments were all about. We had planned 10 commandments, 10 sermons, and then we had two closures. We had Easter. Joni and I were gone to Florida to help the kids move, then to California for the wedding. And so all of a sudden, 10 weeks become 16 weeks, and here we are on Memorial Day, right on the cusp of official summer. And I noticed Laverne slandered me by going from my membership class being spring to maybe summer or fall. We'll get there. It's going to happen. But we're right there. It's amazing. Can you imagine we're starting the sixth month of 2018 already? It's a blink, isn't it? Doesn't time go fast? Our grandson Tanner is going to be 10 months old. You know, a year ago he was still a baby bump, and now Ann sent me a picture and he's wearing 12-month-old clothes at 9 3/4 months. He's a tank. There's certain aspects of life that really cause us to ponder the fleeting nature of human existence. Weddings are one, births are another, anniversaries, and unfortunately deaths. And we have experienced significant ones as a faith community this past year. It causes us to reminisce, to look back, to ponder. And what happened is I was doing that, the lyrics of an old song that go way back popped into my head. When I was a kid, my parents had a console stereo. Does anybody know what I'm talking about? It was about this long right here. It was made of furniture. It had a big speaker on one side. It had a side that lifted up, and it had a turntable in it. My dad would keep his record albums in there. I couldn't touch it. It was totally forbidden for me. But he played it, and he would tend to do it on Saturday nights. And my dad learned to play the harmonica in World War II, and so maybe that's why we won. But anyway, he got some harmonica records he would listen to, and he also liked Tennessee Ernie Ford and a lot of the gospel songs. And so I grew up with that in my background. And one of the songs that Tennessee Ernie Ford sang was 16 Tons. And there's a famous lyrics in there that says, "Another day older and deeper in debt." Anybody recognize that? Yeah, most of you have heard that. And what happens, unfortunately, is most of us have experienced that at times in our life when we were another day older and deeper in debt, when things were kind of tough. Well, that phrase is just as spot on today as it was when it was written. And you know, it was all written there about that 16 tons of coal. And those people, those miners, worked for the company store. Their paycheck was deposited in there so that they could go and get their food and their supplies from there. And what happened is it became, over time, almost like indentured servanthood, because they wouldn't work enough to pay for the inflated prices. And that's what would happen. Well, we have our own company store today. It's different than it was back then. But it's wrapped around our finances and the way we do life in modern America. Credit cards, online shopping, names like Amazon, eBay, Overstock, Wayfair, and Hayneedle. The last three I had not even heard of. Joni told me about those. And we have instant access to these products. And so you see the gal there, she's on her laptop with her credit card in hand. You go to Amazon, you find all these great deals. Sometimes they ship it to you for free. The trouble is that it is so easy that we might not pay attention to where the money that's going to fund that comes from. And then you start dealing with credit card debt or PayPal that's attached to an account. And all of a sudden, people today have a new company store. I sold my soul to the company store, and it happens through a credit card. Because it's so easy. You can do it in your pajamas. You can do it in your underwear. You can do it in the worst old t-shirt you have because you don't have to leave the house to go shopping. until the bills show up. And those are just as effortless until you have to pay for them. So, question: how did this worldwide epidemic of consumerism come about? This endless desire for this unlimited supply of stuff, because anything that you want is available online. How did this come about? Is it something that's new to humanity? Did it happen just because of the internet? Did it happen just because of capitalism? Because we have seen in the last year or two certain politicians who are bringing back the idea of socialism. Socialism and communism. And those were great ideas. When you read them on paper, you think, wow, this is a great idea. Until you realize that they were a dismal failure. They were awful. Why? Simply because the human heart is sinful and wicked. And everybody vies for power. We have this persistent craving for acquiring and spending and hoarding, getting. What really drives this? That's what we're going to talk about today. If you take your Bibles and look at Exodus chapter 20, verse 17, commandment 10. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, or his male or female servant, his ox or his donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor. This is quite an extensive list of things that God prohibits the Israelites from doing, and it has modern counterparts. I'll tell you what, it was kind of fun to live in a $1 million house for a week. Would I want to stay there? No, because I hate Southern California traffic. But it was kind of fun. And then you've got the picture-perfect wife until the guy who marries her and tells you they're false because you've got this illusion. And the male servants just down the block, there were people working on yards and gardening and like that, being able to hire that today. Everything has a counterpart. We don't have oxes and donkeys, but people have horses. I have no idea why. I wouldn't give you a nickel for all of them, but we have relatives who are into horses. You know, they're big and they eat a lot and they're unpredictable and they throw you on the ground. But some people like them. They're status. If you like horses, I'm sorry. Okay? And then it says anything else your neighbor owns, boats. I saw yesterday, I was looking out the window, and I saw a truck with a boat that was bigger than the truck. I mean, like, this was a giant boat. Come right up to the corner right here and turn going down Wilson. I'm going, holy mackerel. How does anybody afford a boat like that or a swimming pool? It is so easy to look at what other people have, and you want it. You want it. So there's two key words in this right here that we're going to look at to start out. Neighbor and covet. We need to define those. Well, Jesus answers the first question of, if you can switch slides here, whomever is our neighbor. Who is our neighbor? Jesus answered it in the parable of the Good Samaritan. Now we're starting, and this is, we always start off with the Old Testament, so this is just going to be a snapshot of it, and you know the story. But what happens is he was talking with some religious leaders of that time, and they asked him about the teaching of the Bible. And he says in Luke 10:27, love the Lord your God with all your soul, with all your strength, with all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. It's all about love. It's extending out to that. Well, being these teachers of the law, these experts, and always questioning Jesus' teaching, the next verse, this leader says, who's my neighbor? Define it. Who is my neighbor? So is my neighbor the guy across the road and the guy across the road here? So Jesus says, no. He says, a man goes on a journey and he gets attacked by thieves and robbers and they leave him stripped and bleeding and dying. And along comes a religious leader and sees him and goes to the other side of the road. He doesn't want to get involved. Don't want to get involved. And then along comes another one, a Levite, and does the same thing. And finally, along comes a Samaritan who was someone in their society who was low class on a donkey. And rather than going to the other side of the road, he picks him up, puts him on the donkey, takes him to an inn, leaves money for him. And Jesus says, which of those was the neighbor? Well, they didn't even want to say the word Samaritan, so they said the person who took care of them. And Jesus says, go and do likewise. That defines who your neighbor. Everyone is our neighbor. It's not just someone who lives in proximity to you. My neighbors in California, in that house, the guy walked by with two dogs last Sunday night and we chatted with him. We had new neighbors that night. You know, Karen, I talked to her on the phone last night and she said, you know, with all the death and everything that we've had, she said she has this passion for saying to people, where are you going? What's your future? Having that care means they're your neighbor. So do we have that clear? Your neighbor is everyone. No one is excluded from that. The second one in our primary order of business today is the second question. What does it mean to covet? That picture right there should tell you what it is. The kid's happy with his little frozen treat until he looks at the girl who's got an ice cream cone that's twice as big. Isn't that the way we are? The word covet, according to the Nelson's New Illustrated Bible Dictionary, is an intense desire to possess something or someone that belongs to another person. If you ask the kid right here, which one of those do you want? He would take her ice cream cone in a minute, right? He might give her his thing right there to swap it, and he might want both of them. It goes on to say, it springs from a greedy, self-centered, and arrogant disregard for God's law. None of those terms are flattering. Greedy, self-centered, and arrogant disregard for God's law. As we look at this, this 10th commandment is not just a period at the end of a long sentence, it's an exclamation point. This whole issue of coveting wraps up everything, and we're going to see that shortly. Because what happens is coveting draws you into so many of the other violations of commandments. So we're going to look at here. Now, theologian and author Edmund Clowney, teaching from his Sunday school book, Forever, it'll be a little longer, and a book that I obtained on the Ten Commandments, he says it this way, this command does not simply warn the Israelites about stealing the belongings of others. It goes much deeper. Get this, it goes much deeper. Requiring that God's people should not even desire what belongs to another. It focuses not on actions, but on attitudes. Just like Jesus said, if you look at a woman with lust in your heart, you've already committed adultery. This goes to your attitude. This goes to the secret stuff. You might never steal something, but if you have this in your heart, it already begins a seed. It speaks not just of what we do, but what we want to do. That's where it gets serious. The core issue of this is idolatry. Jesus says, or God says, don't have any graven images. Don't make anything. What happens here is covetousness is idolatry, because what happens is we want something more than we want God. We love the gift more than the giver. And the thing of it is it always starts with the eyes. We're going to look at three examples from the Old Testament, three illustrations that are going to show this. The first one comes out of Genesis chapter 3. We looked at this a couple weeks ago with Adam and Eve in the garden encountering the serpent. In Genesis 3:6, Eve has already had this encounter. She's already unsettled because the serpent has thrown some things out at her. And it says in Genesis 3:6, when the woman saw the fruit of the tree that was good for food, and it was pleasing to the eye, and also desirable for gaining wisdom, she took some and she ate it. She also gave some to her husband who was with her, and he ate it. Note the progression here, because there's always a progression. With covetousness, you've got to check this at the door. Eve saw the fruit. The serpent pointed it out. Probably they had just sort of backed away and they said, that's the tree that God has forbidden. Don't even get near it. The serpent draws the attention, and Eve, like a laser beam, all of a sudden she looks at it. And she found it pleasing to the eye. Hmm. This wasn't ugly. This wasn't a cactus of spines. This was pleasing to the eye. That's the next step. Eyes are central to coveting. The Hebrew term avah is what coveting is all about. When Moses gave the law in Deuteronomy chapter 5 to the second generation of these Israelites. Remember, the first generation out of Egypt had gotten this, and they were the ones that died in the desert. He gave it again to the second generation, and he used this word avah to go right back in parallel what Eve had happened to her in Genesis 3:6. It defines covet. Her eyes led her to fiercely desire the forbidden fruit, and the forbidden is the part of it. Okay? We want what we can't have. We want it all the more. That's that contrary, perverse part of our nature. So she picked it, she ate it, she gave it to her husband, and brought sin and death in the world. The second part is 2 Samuel chapter 11. This one is going to be familiar to my Sunday school class because we talked about this a few weeks ago. This is David and Bathsheba. 2 Samuel 11, 1 through 5, in the spring. At the time when kings go off to war, David sent Joab out with the king's men and the whole Israelite army. They destroyed the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah. But David remained in Jerusalem. When kings go out to war, David stayed at home. One evening, David got up from his bed and walked around on the roof of the palace. From the roof, he saw a woman bathing. The woman was very beautiful, and David sent someone to find out about her. The man said, "This is Bathsheba. She is the daughter of Eliam and the wife of Uriah the Hittite." Then David sent messengers to get her. She came to him and he slept with her. Now she was purifying herself from her monthly uncleanness, which means that she was ovulating, perfect time. Then she went back home. The woman conceived and sent word to David saying, "I'm pregnant." Example number two. It begins with the engagement of the eyes. David was where he shouldn't have been. He should not have been on the roof of his palace. He should have been at war. Should have been with his army. And like Eve, he found this woman pleasing to the eye. It says she was beautiful. You know, the question is if she had been, you know, old or ugly or whatever, you know, that's not the issue. Because she was beautiful, just like the fruit was attractive. David had flamed with lust. So he sent someone out to find out about her. He should have left the roof. He should have cleansed his mind. Instead, he took it to the next level. When he finds out who she is, he should have known better. He sent someone to get her. His downward spiral. He's being sucked into a black hole. She came to him and he slept with her. And in the final results of this, the woman conceived and sent word to David saying, "I'm pregnant." We looked at this passage earlier in the Ten Commandments. In James 1, 14 and 15, it says, "Each person is tempted when they are dragged away by their own evil desires." You're dragged away by your own evil desires. Every one of us has experienced this, where you're going along and suddenly something pops up. And you know, just like repentance, you should turn your back. But it pulls you like a moth to the flame. You're pulled towards it. It's dragging you towards it. Dragged away and enticed. Then after desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin. And sin, when it's full grown, gives birth to death. That's exactly what happened. This verse is exactly what happened in 2 Samuel chapter 11. Once David finds out she's pregnant, he recalls Uriah, her husband, and tries to get him to sleep with her. He wants to cover his tracks. It doesn't work. Uriah is the more righteous one. David should have been at war. Uriah was at war, and he says, "That's not what we do. That's not what we do." So then David, in desperation, he sends him back and he tells Joab, put him in a dangerous part of the battle where the fighting is the fiercest, and as predicted, Uriah was killed. But the Lord knew about the whole thing. But God sees everything. In the next chapter, chapter 12, he sends Nathan, the prophet, to confront him about this. He violated commandment 6. He committed a murder because he had violated commandment 7, which is adultery. But primarily he violated commandment number 1 because he didn't love God with his whole heart. David installed himself as king on his own throne, and he took over and he violated God's laws, and you see what happened. And it brought judgment on his family, turmoil, Absalom, all these things because of that sin. All because of covetousness. It starts with the eyes. The last one is in 1 Kings chapter 21. 1 Kings chapter 21. This is another sordid situation where kings misuse their power. Ahab, Naboth, and wicked Jezebel. 1 Kings 21, verses 1 through 10. Sometime later, there was an incident involving a vineyard belonging to Naboth, the Jezreelite. The vineyard was in Jezreel, close to the palace of Ahab, king of Samaria. Ahab said to Naboth, "Let me have your vineyard to use as a vegetable garden, since it is close to my palace. In exchange, I will give you a better vineyard, or if you prefer, I will pay you whatever it is worth." But Naboth replied, "The Lord forbid that I should give you the inheritance of my ancestors." So Ahab went home sullen and angry, because Naboth the Jezreelite had said, "I will not give you the inheritance of my ancestors." He lay on his bed sulking and refused to eat. You can already tell his character there. Grown men are not supposed to pout. Right? So, his wife Jezebel came in and asked him, "Why are you so sullen? Why don't you eat? What's your deal, dude?" she's saying. And he answered, "Because I said to Naboth the Jezreelite, 'Sell me your vineyard, and I would give you another one in his place.' But he said, 'I'll not give you my vineyard.'" Can't you hear him? He was whining. Jezebel, he says, "How is this that you act like this as king of Israel?" She's incredible. She says, "How can you act like this? You're the king. Get up and eat. I'm going to fix it for you. I'll get you the vineyard." So she wrote letters in Ahab's name, placed a seal on them, and sent them to the elders and nobles who lived in Naboth's city. In the letter she wrote, "Proclaim a day of fasting and seat Naboth in a prominent place among the people, but seat two scoundrels opposite him and have them bring charges that he has cursed both God and the king. Then take him out and stone him to death." Now this is a pretty picture, isn't it? This is really a neat story. Let's make a Bible movie about this one. No. You've got wicked Ahab. He wants the property of another Israelite. And it sounds like he was reasonable. He approaches him, he makes him an offer, but the guy turns him down. The core issue here, we've already talked about when we talked about moving an ancient boundary stone. See, what happens in the land of Palestine, they believed that when God gave them the promised land, that the land that they were given was an inheritance from God. That specific spot was his blessing, his inheritance. It was their promise that was given to Abraham that your offspring will own the land. So, of course, in verse 3, he says, "The Lord forbid that I should give you the inheritance of my ancestors." It wasn't just a piece of ground to him. It wasn't like saying, "Will you come and sell me this donkey?" It was his share that he had inherited from generation to generation. And to Ahab, he didn't care. He had all these holdings, and it was just trading land. So he's sitting there sulking and pouting on his bed, and Jezebel comes in, and she goes, "I'll fix it." Jezebel was a Sidonian. He had married a pagan woman from a region along the coastline of there in Palestine, and they worshiped the Baals. At that point, Ahab was totally pagan. She had no moral compass. So she came up with a scheme. Okay, this is what royalty does. Write a letter. Tell him to invite him to a banquet. Accuse him and take him out and kill him. That's exactly what happened. His eyes, wanting that vineyard, brought about the death of a person, just like David's had brought about the death of a person. How Eve and Adam brought about the death of a complete race to sin, violating these commandments. We're going to switch gears here to the New Testament. Turn over to Matthew chapter 6. We're going to see how Jesus expands upon this in Matthew chapter 6, Sermon on the Mount. We've already looked at verses 6, 19 and 20 already when we talked about stealing. Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and vermin destroy and where thieves break in and steal. But store up for yourself treasure in heaven where moth and vermin do not destroy and where thieves do not break in and steal. Verse 21, but where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. There your heart will be also. This begs the question, what is your treasure? What do you value? What do you prize most highly? What do you seek after with all your heart? Is it God or is it things of the earth? For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. 22 through 24, Jesus expands. He says, the eye is the lamp of the body. If your eyes are healthy, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eyes are unhealthy, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light within you is darkness, how great is that darkness? No one can serve two masters. Either you will hate the one and love the other, or you will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. After asking this question about where your treasure is, he goes on in 22 in the first part of 23, and he ties it all together in an amazing metaphor. He says, the eye is the lamp of the body. Do you notice how Eve looked with her eyes at the fruit? David looked with his eyes at Bathsheba. Ahab looked at Naboth's vineyard. It starts with the eyes, and Jesus says, the eye is the lamp of the body. If your eye is healthy, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eyes are unhealthy, your whole body will be full of darkness. The eye is like a flashlight. It shines what's in there. It shines our path so we look for pitfalls and we can avoid them. But it's even more than that. It reveals our inner state of being. What we look at and what we crave, what we desire, is telling of us. If you have bright eyes, the ability to assess the truth of valuing God's word and God's way above it. It's equated to us being healthy inside, spiritually healthy. Your whole body will be full of light. It comes from having a proper station, a position for your possessions. Can you flip it to the eyes when you're a slide ahead there, Laverne? Here we go. The eye on the right is the healthy eye. And there's a but in here, the eye on the left. And you can see it shrouded in blackness. Did I have that right, left? No. Well, it's my right and left. Your left and right, okay? Stage left, stage right. How is that? The opposite is just as true. If your eyes are unhealthy, if you covet other things, if you hoard your stuff, your whole body will be full of darkness. And you can see this. It's kind of graphic. When I saw these pictures, I went, wow. It was almost like they were put there just to illustrate this point. Can you get it with a picture? A picture's worth 1,000 words. You can see, and it says, if then the light within you is darkness, how great is the darkness? The darkness comes from following the path of Satan. He dangles his stuff out here. He gets us chasing it like a fish. And we end up in the live well, waiting to get cooked. That's the picture right here. It's like calling untruths little white lies to reduce the sin value. We like to scale them. God doesn't. Sin is sin. Greed and coveting. This is a great darkness to the soul. And you can see it in our American culture. Okay, Laverne, now you can change that. Jesus wraps up this in no uncertain terms. He says, no one can serve two masters. Either you will hate the one and love the other, or you'll be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. The first four commandments are vertical. and it says you can't serve any other masters. Mark Cuban is a pro team owner. Look at that quote he has. Work like there is someone working 24 hours a day to take it all away from you. That's great if you're the CEO and you're getting all this kind of money and you're a workaholic and you don't care about your family and you don't care about anything else. How do you think that affects family life if you work that way? How do you think it affects your spiritual life? No one can serve two masters. It says you'll either hate and despise one or love and be devoted to the other. You cannot serve both God and money. Many have tried. They tried to find a balance in that. I've seen people who are successful in business and they try to walk that line. And it's really difficult, if not impossible, because what happens is your eyes are going to go towards the one that you focus the most upon. It darkens your vision with covetousness. We have this constant desire for more, bigger, better, newer, even dish soap, laundry detergent, new and improved. What did they do to laundry detergent to make it that much better? Seriously? They just put that on there. But we buy it. We get caught. Moss to the flame. Karen, if you would come on up, please, as we reflect this morning. I really enjoy and appreciate contemporary Christian music. But you know what? Sometimes I find myself reflecting on the hymns that I learned as a kid as I was singing. And the song, the words of this song just popped into my mind to close as your reflection. Turn your eyes upon Jesus. It says, O soul, are you weary and troubled? The darkness within. No light in the darkness I see. Can you see how it ties in? There's light for a look at the Savior and life more abundant and free. Turn your eyes upon Jesus. This is the key. Turn your eyes upon Jesus. Look full in his wonderful face. When you look at that picture, aren't you attracted to him? That's what Gary is seeing, Jesus up close and personal. And the things of earth will go strangely dim. You know something? When you're looking straight ahead, the things on the periphery are out of focus. The things of earth will go strangely dim in the light of his glory in grace. Take a moment and meditate on that, and we'll close in prayer.